So tonight's topic is karma and rebirth. These two things are almost always taught together. They're like the two sides of a coin. Can't have one without the other, sort of thing. And but I'm going to sort of start with one and then move on to the other. But yeah, I'll flow back and forth a little bit. Let's start with karma. Karma, first of all, means both action and results of an action. So it's both the action itself and the result of that action are both two different forms of karma in a sense. And basically, every teaching I've ever seen on karma has this basic idea that wholesome, skillful acts have wholesome karma, and unwholesome, unskillful acts have unwholesome karma. And that karma, the results of your actions, essentially accumulates. So if you have a lot of unwholesome actions and unwholesome karma arising, then you're going to have to deal with that at some point. The some point is, we'll talk about that in a while. The interesting thing, however, is that we're talking about acts that are intentional. Anything that you do where you form an intention and result in some volitional act, that's when karma arises based on the results of that action or the wholesomeness of that action. Otherwise, I mean, it's something, you're sitting there and someone, taps your knee and your leg kicks out and you kick somebody. That's just, natural reflexive action, no karma involved. So it's like they have to be intentional actions. And we don't have to even believe that there's in more than one lifetime or one more or rebirth or any of those sorts of things. Just look at what goes on in your own life. We all have acted in wholesome and unwholesome ways in our lives. We're human beings. And if you look back at your life and you can see where you've done something that was, say, less than wholesome, then you at some point, either you already have or you have the feeling you're going to have to deal with that. It's going to be some unpleasantness arising out of the fact that you acted or spoke in a certain way back then. And vice versa, if you did have done some things that are quite wholesome and now you're reaping the rewards of that wholesomeness in your in this life. There's a phrase in you see sometimes called "As you sow, so shall you reap." We're sowing our karma as we act in the world, and then we reap the benefits or the problems related to it. And this whole idea, it's not like this is some strange Eastern idea, though it might be expressed in different ways in Western cultures. For instance, this is a story one of my teachers told me. He and another teacher, two very senior teachers in the lineage of teaching that I'm part of, went and spent some time teaching Dhamma to a whole bunch of people on death row. Tough gang members, sort of people. And they were just like, they were talking about all these different things and loving kindness, and these guys were just like, give me a break. And they felt like they weren't getting anywhere with these guys. And there's one guy who's like the gang leader, who is just like poo-pooing everything they say and arguing and just so they're having a difficult time. And then they go in and they talk about karma. And the gang leader, you can see, they can see it's like the light come on in his eyes. And he said, "Oh, you mean what goes around comes around," which in his language was, that's how you experience karma. What goes around comes around. So this is like San Francisco gang guys, and they understood this. This was part of their culture. And so we all have a sense for that this sort of makes sense in a way, right? Here's another way you can look at this. Actually, I have my laptop. I like this. This is that what I'll call the long-term view. Karma can be simply be taken as the result of birth. You take a human body, and inevitably there will be sickness, old age, and death. That's the karma of being born. Just being born. This is the results. It's going to be experienced. Just an interesting way to look at it. Another way to look at it is you're doing something wholesome, and then you remember that act later, and you get a good feeling. There's something that memory, excuse me, it is hay fever season. That memory in and of itself is wholesome. As long as it isn't, "Oh, aren't I great?" sort of memory. It's just like, there's a sweetness that you've experienced when you remember something that you've done in the past that was wholesome. And vice versa, of course. Of course, the same applies to unwholesome actions. Then you feel regret and remorse and emotional energy that is not often very pleasant at all. And this is just normal. This is natural. I wanted to read a couple of things here. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. He's talking about this whole idea and how we don't have to believe anything I've been saying. This isn't like dogma. This isn't like believe this or you're out of the club, right? And he points it out very nicely here. For me, there was a very gradual process in opening to these possibilities. I came to Dharma practice from a study of Western philosophy. And I had no belief at all in past and future lives and other realms of existence. Over time, though, several things began to open my mind. First, the more I practiced and studied the Dhamma, because so much of what the Buddha said did resonate with what I was experiencing, I began to think that if he was right about so much, maybe I could keep an open mind about what is still beyond my immediate experience. I began practicing poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge's willing suspension of disbelief. So you don't have to believe, but you have to try and willingly suspend your disbelief, which is very different. This is saying, disbelief is like, nope, that's nonsense, blah, blah, blah. The suspending your disbelief is like, well, it could be this, it could be that. I'm open to this. I want to until it's. I saw that just as we can become attached to our belief systems, which we do, we can also become attached to our disbeliefs. That's a really wise statement. I know this isn't true. Brr. And we become attached to that idea. And then, when something happens or arises that's contrary to that, then we find some excuse for how that couldn't be that way. I didn't see it correctly, or blah, blah, blah. It's just He's pointing to the need to keep an open mind more than anything else. It's not like you have to believe or disbelieve. Just keep an open mind. And over time, with experience, in the practice, these things, as he said, just become more obvious in a way. More like they make sense. They feel, you feel it on an existential level that somehow all this fits. On the other side of the coin, this is the Samyutta Nikaya, which is, Samyutta means collected. So this is the collected discourses. So this is a collection of, here's 137 suttas, 137 times the Buddha spoke about a particular topic. And he's talking about the idea that when things happen to us, especially unpleasant things, but sometimes pleasant things too, it's our karma. Right? That famous song, "It's my karma and I'll cry if I want to," you know. It's like we have this idea somehow that everything that's happening is because of something that happened before, whether it's in this lifetime or, they can go back into past lifetimes. Here's what the Buddha had to say. I think this is, I love this because it's so blunt. This wanderer approached the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Blessed One, "Master Gotama, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, all that is caused by what he has done in the past. What does Master Gotama say about this?" So he's asking very directly. This was the traditional form of belief around karma that was prevalent in North India at the time of the Buddha, and is actually still prevalent in much of Southeast Asia today. He's saying some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders. That some feelings arise here originating from bile disorders, one can know for oneself, and that is considered to be true in the world. Now, when these ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, whatever a person experiences, whether it be pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, all that is caused by what has been done in the past, they overshoot what one knows for oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins. So he's like outright saying, nope, not true. But then he goes on, just sort of to make his point. Some feelings arise here originating from phlegm disorders, originating from wind disorders, originating from imbalance of the three. So this is the classical Ayurveda medical diagnosis. Produced by change of climate, produced by careless behavior, caused by assault, produced as the result of karma, that some feelings arise here produced as the result of karma one knows for oneself. And that is considered to be true in the world. So I said, yeah, some things that arise in the moment are based on actions the accumulated karma from the past. That karma is now coming into fruition, is the word they use. But he noticed the long list of other things it could be. So he's saying, yes, karma is one of the many reasons things arise in the world, but there's lots of other reasons. And to narrow it all down to just this one thing is incorrect. In fact, then he goes on, he says, "Now when these ascetics and Brahmins hold such a doctrine and view as this, all is caused what has been was done in the past, they overshoot what one knows by oneself, and they overshoot what is considered to be true in the world. Therefore, I say that this is wrong on the part of those ascetics and Brahmins." So he's being quite emphatic here, as the Buddha often is, about this idea that everything is caused by our karma. Some things arise that, we've acted improperly in the past, something, and then sure enough, what goes around comes around, right? And we have to then deal with that. We have to be able to work skillfully with that. Okay. So karma does not mean predestination, but that your life is controlled from above, like there's some magical being that controls everything, right? Or that you have no choice. This is the classic view of people who are sort of like, oh, my karma is so bad, and nothing I can do about it. Well, actually, there is, right? The seeds you planted will sprout, but you have free will to react to these events. So even if it's karma from past experiences that's arising now, you have a choice of how you react to those things arising. This is where free will comes into play in the Buddhist teachings over and over and over again. She says the same thing. And this is essentially what we're trying to do with this practice. We're trying to learn to react more skillfully to what's arising in the present moment, because often we don't. And the pain, the suffering arises not from what arose, but from how we reacted to it. And there's a big difference. And also he says, also how these events affect you is to a large extent determined by your mind state at the time they arise. If you're mindful and full of loving kindness, when something difficult arises, you will deal with it much better than if you are distracted and full of ill will. So this is like, oh, can I sort of generally maintain a life full of loving kindness and calm? And then when these things that are going to arise, I can then deal with them more skillfully. Not get caught up in them, not get caught in the rant world of, it's not fair, it shouldn't be happening to me, those sorts of places we often end up if we're not careful. Joseph Goldstein has a little more to say here about this. Examining the deeper implications of this step on the path leads us to a subtler understanding of the Buddhist teachings. For example, Bhikkhu Bodhi points out that acts can be driven by greed, hatred, or delusion, and that killing driven by hatred is the most serious, particularly if it's premeditated, because there have been many intense mind moments that have gone into planning and thinking about it. Lots of accumulated unwholesome karma. Always, the unwholesome karma is proportional to the force and strength and duration of the defilements that brought it about. Later teachings also explain that the consequences or results of an action are conditioned by the moral qualities of both the actor and the recipient of the act. This is true of both negative and positive actions. For example, on the positive side, gifts are purified both by the motivation of the giver and also the purity of the recipient. In this light, it was considered inestimable merit to make an offering to the Buddha or to other enlightened beings. At the same time, in the perfection of generosity, we give without discrimination whenever the opportunity is there. It's not that an act of generosity or an act of harm has some absolute karmic consequence. Rather, the karmic fruits of these actions are conditioned by various factors, including the intensity and duration of the defilements or wholesome motivations and the purity of both the actor and the recipient of the action. So this isn't sort of what he's pointing to is people think of this as like black and white. You did that, therefore in your next birth you're going to be born with only one leg. I mean, stuff It's amazing what people have told me they think they believe, right? And it's just like, no, who knows? We have to sort of keep a much more open mind about this. We have to understand, however, that the results of our actions are something we're going to have to deal with, but it's not like this absolute black and white world at all. So that's what I want to say about karma. Then we have rebirth. In my notes here, I have rebirth, not reincarnation. This is a subtle difference, and hopefully I can bring that out as I talk about this. And I also have to say right now, I don't know this to be true, what I'm about to say. I haven't consciously experienced it directly. I don't have any direct knowledge of what I'm saying. But it makes sense to me. And this is like over many long years of listening to my teachers and reading the sutta and studying. This is more than anything else I've come across. What I'm going to say now, it makes more sense to me than anything else I've ever heard about rebirth. Let's start with, of course, the Buddhist words. This is once again from the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is another one of those things that I really teaches that I really like. It's a really interesting take on rebirth in a sense. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahakasapa and the Venerable Sariputta were dwelling in Varanasi. Then in the evening, the Venerable Sariputta emerged from seclusion and approached the Venerable Mahakasapa. So these are two senior disciples of the Buddha. He exchanged greetings, and then they concluded their greetings and cordial talk. He sat down to one side and said to him, "How is it, friend Kasapa? Does the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata exists after death." "Then, friend, does the Tathagata not exist after death?" "Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either. The Tathagata does not exist after death." "How is it then, friend? Does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this. The Tathagata both exists and does not exist after death." "Then, friend, does the Tathagata neither exist nor not exist after death?" "The Blessed One, friend, has not declared this either." So this is classical philosophical discursion, where you take two things, he exists, he doesn't exist, and you look at all four options, right? He does, he doesn't, he doesn't, he both does and doesn't, or he neither does and doesn't. Those are only four possible, right? So at this point, Sariputta is getting frustrated, right? Oh, I'm trying. It's got to be one of those four, right? And then, so he says, "Why hasn't the Blessed One declared this, friend?" And Kasapa replies, "Because this is unbeneficial, irrelevant to the fundamentals of the holy life, and does not lead to dispassion, cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana. Therefore, the Blessed One has not declared this." So what he's basically saying is, the Blessed One doesn't say anything about it because it really isn't relevant to our own practice. This is like philosophical nitpicking. And we sort of crave answers to these sorts of questions because there's these big philosophical questions and we want answers to them because it's like then everything is going to make sense, we foolishly think. And the Buddha, this is one place where the Buddha does this sort of thing, but there's lots of other places in the sutta where the Buddha says, just won't say. Like for instance, how did the world start? How's the world going to end? Who knows? And Buddha may said, who cares? Don't pay attention to that. Just, pay attention to the practice. In fact, this is what he said. So this is a, and what friend has the Blessed One declared? The Blessed One friend has declared, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, and this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, like the original teaching, the Four Noble Truths. And why, friend, has the Blessed One declared this? Because, friend, this is beneficial, relevant to the fundamentals of the holy life. So, understanding the Dhamma and practicing the Buddhist teachings, that's what we need to do. We don't need to, our Western minds in particular want to figure everything out. I want to have an explanation. And the Buddha emphatically over and over says, don't waste your time doing that. Practice instead. And when through your practice, you'll come to understand these things in a totally deeper, non-intellectual way. Don't try and figure this stuff out. Good advice for everyone, including me sometimes. The other thing about that thing I just read is why wouldn't the Buddha say one of those? It's one of those four things, because all four of those exist after death, doesn't exist after death, both exist and doesn't exist. Those all four imply that there's a separate self that's going to continue after death. If it's one of those four, there has to be something that does the continuing, right? And the Buddha didn't talk about that at all, ever. He intentionally instead talked about the ideas of not-self, of there not being something that continues on. In fact, in moment-to-moment existence right now, if you look closely enough, you'd see that you're totally discontinuous and not solid at all, as you go deeper into what the Buddha says. But for the terms of, in terms of rebirth itself, what the teaching that resonates most clearly with me, based on these things I've been reading, is you, the personality, Barry, in my case, doesn't come back in a new body. There's no rebirth for this personality. When this personality dies, which it always does, right, it's gone. The barrenness doesn't continue on anymore. So you don't reincarnate. And the reason reincarnation teachings are generally expressed in the way that it says, yes, well, that's exactly what happens, is because if we're believing that, then this is a subtle form of clinging for continued existence. I want to keep going. I don't want to end. It's one of the deeper things that we cling to. The Buddha teachings on clinging, the second noble truth, basically, we cause our own suffering by clinging. This is one of the central ones that we get caught in over and over again. I want to keep going. I want continued existence. So, well, if I reincarnate, well, no, that's good. I've got some belief in this. And we also were clinging to this idea of continued existence. We're also clinging to some idea of a separate self. Call it a soul or whatever you want to call it, that continues after we die. We cling to this idea because it's scary as hell to not believe that this just ends. One more little bit from Joseph here. He's talking about this, what's called the craving for becoming, or clinging to becoming. On a more momentary level, We can see this craving for becoming in our relationship to the unfolding process itself. Even if we don't have expectations for some big, wonderful experience, how often do we seem to be leaning forward into the next moment, as if somehow the next step, the next breath, the next sensation or thought will resolve everything, complete everything. We can see this leaning happen when we're feeling something unpleasant and watching for it to change. Or we can see it when we're being with some emotion and wanting to feel it more deeply. This sense of leaning forward, anticipating the next moment, is also a kind of craving for becoming. Here, we're not seeing each of these experiences simply as insubstantial, empty phenomena arising and passing in each moment. We're living in the world of wanting. We forget that liberation is not about becoming or getting, not about holding on or craving or clinging, but of letting go and letting be. Letting go of all these ideas, among other things. But even like in this moment to moment, it's like, how often are we like, you know, not being in the present moment because our mind is out there someplace, what's coming next? You know, what's going to be for dinner? You know, what's going to happen on my job tomorrow? You know, blah, blah, you know, it's endless where we keep leaning into the future instead of being able to just stay in the present moment and be okay with whatever's there. It's a different attitude. So then the question arises, well, if I, Barry, if I don't continue, what's going on here? You know, what's got happening to all that karma I'm accumulating through my wholesome actions? You know, what's happening with that? Here's where this gets a little more academic, perhaps. So basically, the teachings that I understand, and this is directly from one of my teachers, is that when we're conceived, we're connected to what we'll call a bundle of karmic tendencies that we then add to through our life. And so throughout our life, this bundle is changing and hopefully accumulating more wholesome karma based on how we act in the world. And then when you die, it's this bundle that continues and takes another birth. So there's no you there. There's just the result of your actions and the actions of other people who've lived, who've added to this bundle of karmic energy over time. And gradually, the nature of this bundle changes. Who knows how many lifetimes, who knows? It's like you get into all kinds of funny numbers there. And the being that has this, is connected to this bundle of energy at some point, becomes an enlightened being. This is how enlightened beings come into the world, through these bundles of karmic energy gradually growing and improving and becoming more wholesome and more wholesome, and then an enlightened being arises. The interesting thing is, this is the end of the bundle. It's served its purpose. It's created another enlightened being has arisen in the world to teach and lead others, which is the most important thing. Another Buddha, another Jesus has arisen and is acting. Another Mother Teresa, I've always thought of her as an enlightened being. But these bundles, just like everything else, the enlightened being arises at the end of that being's lifetime. The bundle just dissolves. It's gone. It's just another impermanent arising. that happens to have lasted for a really long time. But it's just impermanent like everything else. There's not even this is a permanent thing. There's no place this bundle goes to and lives for eternity, or any of those sort of beliefs. I'm going to read one more thing here. Oh, wait, it's from a different Joseph book. This is Joseph's book, Insight Meditation. And he's talking about this idea of karma and not self, this is what arises and doesn't arise. Although a seed will bear a particular fruit, clearly the seed itself is not the fruit, nor is the seed somehow carried into the fruit. Rather, a process of transformation is happening according to certain laws. The seed grows into a sapling, the sapling into a tree. The tree bears fruit, which brings forth new seed. That first seed is not pulled up through the trunk and then deposited in the fruit, miraculously splitting into all those other little seeds. Rather, the seed undergoes a process of transformation due to certain conditions such as rain, sun, and fertile soil. There is no one element that remains static through this process. Rather, one thing becomes another continuously. What actually happens is the great unfolding from seed to fruit to seed again in an unbroken continuum of becoming, ceaseless change. In fact, these changes are happening so rapidly and so continuously that to isolate any one moment and call it a thing already solidifies too much and renders too static what is so dynamic and transformational. All of the elements of our mind and body are arising and passing away, changing continuously, transforming in exactly the same way. To say that there is no self means that there is no permanent entity that carries over from lifetime to lifetime, or even from moment to moment. Interesting thought. So here's the question that often at this point might arise in you. I mean, this thought might have arisen in your mind already. So I just want to point out this is a question that you might have come across. So we want to ask, where do these bundles of karmic energy come from? This guy's been talking about these bundles of karmic energy. And my answer to that question is, don't. This is what the Buddha called an imponderable. It's another one of those imponderables. Life, like asking how the universe began or how it will end. Thinking about this is only a distraction. It's another thing we don't have to figure out. It's just that's the way things are, right? Another little tidbit. This is a book called What the Buddha Taught by Walpola Arihula, who was a student of, I forget who he is a student of, to be honest with you, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s in India, and then he came back to, I think Poland is where he was originally from, and this book is a result of his life. And he's talking once again about this idea of no permanent, unchanging entity. Now, another question arises. If there's no permanent, unchanging entity or substance like self or soul, what is it that re-exists or is reborn after death? Before we go on to life after death, let us consider what this life is and how it continues now. What we call life, as we so have so often repeated, is the combination of the five aggregates. This is a classic teaching of the Buddha. A combination of physical and mental energies. They are constantly changing, and they do not remain the same for two consecutive moments. Every moment they are born and they die. When the aggregates arise, decay, and die, O bhikkhu, every moment you are born, decay, and die. So things are changing all the time. Thus, even now, during this lifetime, every moment we are born and die. But we continue. If we can understand that this in this life, we can continue without a permanent, unchanging substance like a self or soul, why can't we understand that those forces themselves can continue without a self or soul behind them after the non-functioning of the body? When this physical body is no more capable of functioning, energies do not die with it, but continue to take some other shape or form, which we call another life. In a child, all the physical, mental, and intellectual faculties are tender and weak, but they have within them the potentially of producing a full-grown man. Physical and mental energies, which constitute the so-called being, have within themselves a power to take new form and grow gradually and gather force to the full. This is another sort of angle view at those bundles of karmic energy I was talking about. So now there's another question that often arises at this point. If I don't get to reincarnate, if I don't get another life, why bother to spend all my time trying to be wholesome? Why, if I don't get to really reap the fruits of my actions, or only some of them, through my practice, why am I bothering at all? It's a valid question, isn't it? It's like, because it's like if, and I have two answers to that question. One is, and this is, I think, quite important. We reap the benefits of our practice in this life. This is really clear to me. I look back at my years of practice and how it's changed my life very slowly, little bit by little bit by little bit. I mean, I can't look at one point and say, "Oh, look, the huge change that happened." But if I look at my life now, and well, I started practicing in 1978, so back there, it's really different. It's exceedingly different. And I see that, at least partially, as a pure result of all the time and energy I put into practice over all this time and study and working with other people and living a wholesome life. So, certainly that's true. And that's a good reason to follow the Buddhist teachings in and of itself. But I think there's another way you look at this, and I also hold this in my heart, that we're, if this bundle of karmic energy that I'm attached to at the moment, this me that's working with this bundle of karmic energy, if I'm enhancing and improving that bundle to the point where the next body that takes on that bundle is going to be further along the path until sometime or other, through my actions and the actions of others over however long, an enlightened being is going to arise. That's really important. That's really important to me, that I can contribute in that way to the eventual arising of more enlightened beings in the world. Regardless of whether me, this person, in this lifetime becomes an enlightened being, who knows? I know that that possibility has been, that an enlightened being will arise in the world has increased simply through my actions. This is a valuable thing to hold in my heart. And so that's the answer, I think, to that question, the why bother question I just shared with you. And it's the only answer I've ever come across, to be honest with you, that satisfies me anyway. I have to finish with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Thirst. And she's pointing to the importance of keeping things really simple. Of not, it's so easy with these sorts of teachings that get caught up in the sort of intellectual churn that arises when you start trying to figure this stuff all out. Here's Mary Oliver's answer to that. It's a poem called Praying. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention, then patch a few words together, and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. Enlightenment arises when we just stay open to it and keep things simple. And I wanted to read this intentionally because this whole talk is somewhat less than simple, and it's good to sort of realize this is important because we need to understand this stuff. And at some point, so I've been told, this won't become theoretical ideas. This is like our experience. I'll leave it at that.